Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want. Thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can also find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Ron Strauss, composer, about his new disc and upcoming concert. Right now, I would like to welcome Tom Horn. He is a professor of documentary studies at the Santa Fe Community College, and we're here to talk about 10 documentary films, which is a screening happening tomorrow, Friday, August 28th, from 3 to 9 in the afternoon and evening at the Jean Cocteau Theater. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you. Nice to be here.
And by the way, that's a free program. So documentary studies is something that we have associated with the College of Santa Fe, or the college formerly known as the College of Santa Fe. Mm-hmm. And there's things going on at the Santa Fe Community College. What's happened?
Well, there's a whole program at the community college, and including documentary studies, documentary classes. But we had a one-year certificate program at the College of Santa Fe that where students would start in the fall, continue through the spring and summer semesters. Unfortunately, this year, there was no summer semester.
Right.
So what we had to do is we wanted to be able to let our students finish what they'd started instead of just, you know, there was really kind of a timing thing that went on this whole year where we were building up to getting them ready to work in Final Cut, getting them ready to produce a film and think about films. And it just wasn't going to work to have them have to finish it in the spring.
Right.
So we contacted the Santa Fe Community College, and Monique Anair, who's the director of film over there, allowed us to come over and complete our course there. And we joined up with Jillian Spitzmiller, who's an accomplished filmmaker and a professor over there as well. And Don Usner, who was my partner at the College of Santa Fe, and I joined up with Jillian. And we took our five students from the College of Santa Fe and joined them up with five students from the community college, and it was a great fit, and we're going to show all 10 films on Friday.
So 10 films, 3 to 9 in the afternoon, evening. It's a marathon.
It is a marathon, yeah.
When students make these documentary films, do they start out thinking, I want to make a 45-minute film or a 10-minute film, something like that, or does it really evolve in the process?
Well, last year we kind of had a standard. This class ran the year before, and we did have a kind of a 25-minute standard the year before. This time we kind of said it could be a little shorter, but we have some longer films this year. People just had a lot to say and needed to have the time to say it, and it kind of emerges. You know, it was really interesting a process to see people come in and think, well, maybe I should make a film about this, but I'm not really sure. And you know, a lot of what we did was just to say, you know, it's okay to make this film. It's a good idea. That's what you got coming out of you. And the length of the film emerges in a similar way.
I would think that it would be very important for the film in one way or another to be close to the filmmaker's heart.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. We really stress that, too. We really emphasize that. And I would say every single one of these films is a passionate production.
So when you are taking people through the process of making a documentary film, there's so many stages to it. Walk us through that a little bit. I mean, first there's deciding on the topic, and at the very end there's editing, and there's so much in between.
Oh, yeah. We showed a lot of classic documentaries, and we read books of interviews with filmmakers and really kind of studied what makes a good documentary.
What does make a good documentary?
Well, you know, we used the word passion already. That's a big part of it. You know, craftsmanship's very important. We like to see things done well, not just, you know, one of the fast rules. One of my things that I preached in the fall semester was the worship of the tripod and how wonderful the tripod can act.
As opposed to the handheld camera.
Yeah, it just makes it look
Amen,
a lot better.
Amen, brother.
What's that?
Amen.
Amen, yes. Yeah, let's put those three legs down and, you know, get grounded. So.
There, in a lot of documentaries, particularly ones that address social or environmental problems in one way or another, there tends to be a formula, which is, here's the problem. Mm-hmm. Let's go into the problem further. The problem's really bad. But there's hope. And the music always changes at the but there's hope point. And it's almost become a formula so that you can just sort of plug your social problem into it. And that it's in a way, it's kind of a detriment.
Well, I think we avoided that pretty well with most of these films. I mean, we all have kind of filmmaking in our genes these days. I think we've all grown up as television children and movie children, and I think we can all structure a film in a way more better than we can structure a sentence. And
sad
so, there,
to
so
say.
That's you know kind of that formula does emerge, and it's actually very useful for the craft of the filmmaking. But if you kind of let go of that and just tell your own story, I mean, Don, my partner, he's a writer and a photographer. He really doesn't have much background in filmmaking, but he has a lot of background in classic documentary, and he's the one that just really focused on everyone's story and how you're going to tell your story and what your story is going to be. And he was a great addition to our class.
Well, let's go to some of the filmmakers in the class, and we'll come back to you, Tom Horn, in just a few minutes.
Okay.
I'd like now to welcome Nanda Current and Sultrim Gyatso. Nanda's film is called Beehive in My Heart. It's screening in the 10 documentary films tomorrow, Friday, at the Jean Cocteau Theater. And Sultrim Gyatso's film is called Blood of the Earth, Colorado River. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Nanda, tell us about your film, Beehive in My Heart. This is about a documentary about somebody with a very grave illness.
Beehive in My Heart, the title is from an Antonio Machado poem, and it was a favorite poem of my best friend, Alison Vermond, who died of cancer. But the film is really about her presence in a group of friends' lives and her presence dealing with serious illness and how that deepened in her as a person. And the friends, I worked with people in California, and I worked here with people, so it was a collaboration. So I'm working with some footage that was shot in California. And for years, we worked together doing collaborative performance pieces, and so we thought of this piece as kind of our last performance piece with Allison, even though she isn't with us. So it's a kind of send-off.
Did you have footage of Allison before she got sick?
No, I had no footage of Allison before she's... I did most of what I did with stills, and then I shot video footage, and part of it is narrating some of her writing, her story. There's an essay called The Stranger, and it's about her journey with cancer, and it's kind of the backbone of the film, and people move in and out of it with poetry and story and interviews about Allison.
There's, I would think, with somebody who is suffering a very grave illness, the whole question of what do you want to make public and what do you really want to keep private?
Well, for Allison, it was about living a normal life rather than the identity of having an illness. And so it's really about her friendship and the restorative quality that she had in people's lives more than it's focusing on the story of cancer itself. Cancer was another vehicle in her life for her to live as fully as she wanted to and could.
What was it like for you and the other collaborators to make this film, especially in terms of dealing with loss?
Very emotional for all of us, and yet very cathartic to be able to offer this and honor her and to leave some kind of legacy for her daughter and for other members of the family.
There is something very powerful about just simply a eulogy. Do you see this as a kind of a eulogy?
No, I actually don't. I see it less as a eulogy and more of a story of one person's intensity and presence in this very kind of quiet way that could go unnoticed in our very busy world. It's less of a documentary, it's more of an art film in terms of the footage, the things being expressed, rather than this is Allison in a particular way. I called it a collage of voices because it's voices and impressions of just a small group of people.
Were there any either documentaries or art films that served as a particular inspiration for you?
No, I think the performance work that I had done over the years with this community of people was the incentive for me, because we would gather together and work on a theme of some kind. And the focus was on protecting the natural world. And so we would work on a theme about migration or the loss and the return of the frogs. And so we thought that presence and friendship was the theme of this film. And I thought, well, let's try and do it as a collaborative piece. And when Lorna Kohler did music and did narration, Patrice Vecchione, who's a writer who wrote Writing in the Spiritual Life, talks about Allison's influence on her book. And there's also a piece about her return to Judaism and her involvement with the Aquarian Minion up in Northern California. So
the Aquarian Minion?
The Aquarian Minion.
What's that?
That was a group that she was involved with in terms of the study of the Torah.
Oh, okay.
And it's about her involvement, her very poetic and literary mind, and her involvement with services, and how she entered those stories with a kind of creativity that I think it inhabited some of the community work that we did with children and families with performance.
When you make a film like this about a person who is very beloved to you, are you looking at for the film to have an audience outside of the community that already knew her?
Well, one would hope when somebody does art that it would reach more than just your own personal world. And I would assume that everybody has lost somebody dear to them from cancer or a serious illness, and that friendship is a mainstay of our lives. So I would think on that basis that it would reach a larger community, but it is personal in terms of just about a friend. But I think the meaning of it carries heart in all of our lives.
Nanda Current's film is called Beehive in My Heart, and it is screening at 5:50 among the 10 documentary films tomorrow, August 28th, at the Jean Cocteau Theater. Thank you so much for being with us. Now, Tsultrim Gyatso, you have made a film called Blood of the Earth, Colorado River. How did you get the inspiration for this film?
The reason that I made this documentary is because Tibetan Plateau has these large, great river sources on Tibetan Plateau, and believe it or not, but it's 40% of the world population drinking water is from Tibetan Plateau.
40% of the world's drinking water,
yes.
Population drinking water is from the Tibetan Plateau.
Yes. That's what.
Because so much of it goes to China.
So much goes to China, and South Asia, and India, and Pakistan. So like these seven major rivers, like Yangtze River, Yellow River, Mekong River, Ganges, Dharmaputra, and Indus, and all of these rivers are originated from Tibet. And then the reason that I have to make this documentary is, I wanted to educate the local people on Tibetan Plateau, the Tibetan people, to tell them that there is a river in the United States. It's called Colorado River, and this river is massive used, and there's a lot of fighting for water rights between states and communities, and cities and farmers, and all of that kind of water rights and water conservation and history of the water use and future water supplies. And there's large consideration about the water sources in the future. It's like oil,
right?
And a small point, like for example, as a human body, 70% of body is water. Without water, we cannot survive. So I make this documentary and as a project of Tibetan Ecology Foundation, which I set up, and try to make these kind of documentary from overseas and look at these great rivers and to tell these people, educate them about the river, how you established regulations for water use, water rights, and water conservation. There's a Tibetan culture that has a very deep water conservation concept in traditional way, in Buddhism way. But there's no modern, the modern society these days. The water conservation is not just a belief in the water spirituals, and not a belief, just a belief in a water is a part of your life. There's a lot of things going on, like, you know, China is world power, becoming world power, and it's all of these rivers from Tibetan Plateau feed China and South Asia and all of that part of the world, packed people.
Well, I've read the people have put forward the idea that one of the main reasons for Chinese domination of Tibet is water resources.
Well, you can say that, and what I concern is like my vision is more. It's not about politically, you know, as high greatest lamas are talking now that we don't blame the Chinese want to survive and use resources in Tibet, and what we concern is they came over and to preserve our culture is that what something that we concern and respect our ethnicity rights and environment and conservation, but as my perspective that environmental issue is something. Border of borderless. It's kind of there's no border boundaries between either your Chinese or Tibetan or Muslim. Anybody wants live on this planet.
So, in making a documentary about the Colorado River for Tibetan people, are you making it in a bilingual format?
Right now, the documentary I just finished study from the Santa Fe Community College to edit that, and it's going to be in English and English audio, audio and Tibetan and Tibetan subtitles, and possibly there's Chinese subtitles, but I'm not sure either I should. I'm capable to doing the Chinese subtitle, but definitely there will be English language and Tibetan language both.
So, I mean, certainly the tale of the Colorado River is a very dire tale because the river is so overused and so overallocated. In showing what is going on with the Colorado River, is the point like, don't do this, don't do what we did here?
My organization or myself, Tibetan Ecology Foundation, stays on a genuine line. I don't want to take any side of it. I'm just it's a true documentary. There's no any sound effect too much and things are like that. But anyway, so the documentary tells what's the story about the Colorado River. And water use and water rights, how they establish the water rights and how many people are going to be used. And I am not saying we should do that. I'm just providing the information to Tibetan people saying there's a river, something like this maybe going to happen to us on Tibetan Plateau.
So how do you hope to show it to people? Will you go back to Tibet with the film in your hand?
That's also another possible way, but the thing is, I'm going to put this whole documentary. It's a 53 minutes long, and it's going to be in English version and Tibetan version on the website and a free downloading and free watch. The quality is not be that good as a DVD, but it will be there. And also, I have some other organizations that. To willing to help me to distribute these videos and also trying to get some of the local TV stations in Tibetan Plateau, on Tibetan Plateau, to show on a little chapters every week or sometime.
Tsultrim Gyatso is the filmmaker in the documentary film project studies program whose film is called Blood of the Earth, Colorado River, and that is screening tomorrow, Friday, at 7:35 at the Jean Cocteau Theater. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I'd like now to introduce Katie Cook. She is another filmmaker in this documentary studies program, and her film is called Span New Mexico. Tell me a little bit what the film is about.
Well, Span New Mexico is the story of the mobile spay-and-neuter clinic out of the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society.
So Span is spay and neuter?
Correct.
S-P-A-N.
Correct. Spay and neuter New Mexico, Span New Mexico. And that's the mobile clinic, which is basically a mobile animal surgery hospital that goes out into different communities in the state of New Mexico, offering free to low-cost spay neuters and care to animals in the state who otherwise really would be not receiving care.
And so you got in the van with your camera.
I did. I rode along to two different clinics. I was in both Clovis and Carlsbad, New Mexico, and just tried to kind of chronicle a day in the life of the van, the people who were involved, the ones who are, you know, everybody from the community volunteers to the folks who work on the van, the veterinarian and the two vet technicians, and Ava, the mobile coordinator, who are at every single clinic, and tried to really sort of show the work that these folks are doing, battling over animal overpopulation in the state.
Was it mostly dogs and cats?
I think it is mostly just dogs and cats. There are times where I think maybe they'll get another small animal of sorts, but really for the most part it is dogs and cats.
So what did you see when you were out there that was surprising to you?
You know, I sort of was learning as I was going. This was not an issue I knew a whole lot about. So for me, really kind of getting exposed to, one, what the issues are, and the people who are dedicating their lives to doing something about it, was really inspiring and really moving. And I really was sort of taken by, you know, some of the things that the folks were exposed to. It's just the worst of it. Just some of the stories that they had to tell about, you know, the way certain animals were being treated, or just things that had come up in some of those communities. They get faced with it, the worst of it, and are still showing up to do the work. And I just found that really inspiring, and hopes to do some service to tell their story and the work that they're doing.
People who work in animal welfare are demigods, as far as I'm concerned, because it's so much work. It's always an uphill struggle with really so little reward in a way, because tomorrow the same problem happens all over again.
Right. And I tried to ask them about that, say, you know, how do you stay motivated doing this type of work? And it really was a very, you know, a one-by-one type of attitude, day by day, and, you know, getting discouraged and just showing up the next week because something needs to be done about this, and just caring that much that they're, you know, that they continue to show up and do it and do the work.
So when you're out there in the van, I mean, a mobile spay neuter clinic and veterinary care clinic, you get the word out. I'm sure there's a word of mouth. People hear about it. How much of what you saw the folks doing was about educating people? I mean, there is a hump you have to get over even to convince people that spaying or neutering their dog is a good idea.
Totally. I think, and that's what I continued to hear over and over again, and have included that in the film, is just this discussion of education, that this work needs to be done, that spaying and neutering needs to happen, but that's not going to happen unless people know about it, have access to it, and know that it's important. So, you know, the van, when it travels, I mean, it's just this, it's an RV, you know, kind of turned into a hospital on wheels, and, you know, it's, so the sides are all painted, and, you know, it's just you see it driving down the street, and that creates a lot of excitement and interest. And so they talk about how people do show up just saying, what is this, you know? And it's an opportunity to start talking to people in those communities about what they're there to do, and hopefully slowly in the process of actually doing the work of spaying and neutering, really trying to educate and change people's minds about sort of what that means and the importance of it.
Did you ever see that in real time? I mean, were you able to capture that on your film, the light bulb going off in somebody's eyes, like, oh, I see?
Well, a lot of the people that were, when I was there, a lot of the people that were there because they already knew about it, and they were already very dedicated to the cause. But I think if it were up to the folks doing it, it would be in the schools, it would be sort of doing more outreach in just the kind of educational aspect of it.
So lots of cute puppies and kitties in the movie?
I hope so. I think so, yeah. You know, I got feedback in the making of it. You can't show too many animals, so there's a lot of...
You mean you shouldn't, or...?
You can't show too many. That, you know, people want to see the animals, yeah. So I try to include that as much as possible. And there's a few sort of main characters of animals that I follow their story throughout the whole day, so you get to see sort of each stage of the process through these particular animals.
Now, did you do all your filming actually in one day?
It was over the span of two different clinics and about 3 days of shooting.
Okay.
So the way I, you know, developed the story was a day in the life of the van, but it actually the filming itself took place over 3 or 4 days.
Katie Cook's film is called Span New Mexico, and it is screening at 4:30 tomorrow, Friday, August 28th, at the Jean Cocteau Theater. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And I'd like now to welcome Eric Maddox. His film is called 48 Generations. Welcome.
Thank you.
So 48, 1948.
Yes, correct.
What's the film about?
In a nutshell, the film is kind of the end result of one of those fortunate life accidents that sets your life trajectory on a completely different course. I had moved to the West Bank about a year and a half ago, to complete my graduate research in international conflict resolution. And the place that I was supposed to intern with, Defense for Children International, it turned out I didn't really have much of a place for an intern. So kind of trying to make lemonade out of lemons, submitted a research proposal to the director. I noticed that they had a camera sitting in the corner of their office. I had no prior filming experience whatsoever.
Wow.
And just started jumping on buses with a little camera and interviewing Israelis and Palestinians who had lived through 1948. For those who don't know, 1948 is the year that Israel declared statehood. And so the beginning, or Independence Day for Israelis, and also the beginning of what Palestinians refer to as al-Nakba, or the catastrophe. This is the beginning of what's come to be known as the Palestinian refugee crisis.
So it's such an interesting concept for a film, because you have the beginning of parallel conflicting narratives. I saw a book for school teachers once, for school children, that had the same events, and on one side of the page is the Israeli version of it, and the other side of the page is the Palestinian
Absolutely.
Version of it, and ne'er the twain shall meet, it seems, although people are trying to talk to each other.
And I think, in a way, you've kind of hit the nail on the head. I mean, there's a big wall, as a lot of people might be aware of, that's literally, physically separating these two communities in the West Bank and Israel. So this was kind of the next best thing. If people can't actually meet face-to-face and speak, I can show them answering the same questions, asked in a dispassionate manner. And
what were some of the questions that you asked both sides in dispassion?
Fairly open-ended. The first question that I asked everyone is there a particular anecdote, a particular story that kind of sums up your experience of those historic events? Another question that I asked everyone was, did you share these stories with your grandchildren? Hence the 48 generations part of this title. If you did share them, why? If you didn't, why not? And also asked these questions of their grandchildren. It was just kind of tracing intrafamilial narrative of these events on both sides of the issue, both sides of the wall, if you will. And then the final question that I asked everyone is, do you have anything to say to the children on the other side of this wall? And those answers tended to be the most revealing and the most emotionally driven, understandably. But it was pretty much three questions that I asked a large group of people on both sides, visited refugee camps, villages, kibbutzim, large urban centers, tried to get a decent cross-section.
And so then you came back and said, boy, I better enroll in the documentary studies program and get this thing out.
Absolutely. This stuff sat in a trash bag for about 9 months while I tried to figure out how to put this together. I had no post-production experience either, so that's really what I used this course to do, is figure out how to put all this stuff together in a way that at least begins to do the magnitude of the subject justice.
Do you have a personal narrative going through the film? Are you the narrator?
In kind of an accidental way, yes. Just my own rookie mistakes as an interviewer. Some of my questions were asked in a way that required that you hear the question being asked in order to understand the answer. So you hear my voice a few times. And then I kind of just took that idea and ran with it, and I introduced the movie, and I give some parting reflections at the end. But for the most part, this is just sitting on the couch for an hour with Israelis and Palestinians, literally in their living rooms, talking about how they lived these historic events.
You must have had dozens or hundreds of hours of footage.
I worked really hard for the, 15, 20 hours that I did get. There was a lot of work that went into even lining up these subjects to begin with. You can imagine just distances in that part of the world aren't really measured in kilometers or miles. They're measured more in time. How much time does it take to get through this number of checkpoints to this city? That could be 10 miles away and 2 hours away by bus. So dealing with those kinds of logistical issues, it did reduce my sample size quite a bit, but I ended up with enough to where I reduced the number of interviews I had by quite a bit. So.
Now, did you have any films that served as a model for how to edit this kind of documentary?
Yes and no. Probably get myself a little hot water here, but I've already chosen like the most dangerous subject ever for a first film, so I would say I don't want to be Michael Moore.
Right.
If I have any kind of agenda driving me as a filmmaker, it's a refutation of the idea that certainty is easily come by. And I think that, unfortunately, this conflict has kind of suffered from that kind of oversimplistic analysis as well. And it makes sense. I mean, it's absolutely saturated with media coverage, but it's kind of just one ceaseless catalog of blood vendettas and violence, and that's really not the lived reality that I saw or how people necessarily reflect on their lives in that part of the world. It's much more nuanced. So the idea is that, yeah, you'll hear people saying things that probably people might find difficult to swallow from an ideological standpoint, but trying to get people to understand how they arrived at that place, that current events aren't happening in a historical vacuum. Our lives don't happen in a historical vacuum. So trying to get people to understand how these people's personal historical narratives have shaped the way they look at the world.
So have you shown the film to communities of, or do you plan to, communities of Israelis and Palestinians?
Absolutely. I mean, the one agreement that I had with the organization that I interned with was that I submit this back to them as promotional material. Now, that's Defense for Children International's Palestine chapter, but I also worked less directly, but with the Israeli chapter of that organization as well. They helped me get a number of my Israeli contacts. So had contact with that organization on both sides of the wall. They're a Geneva-based international non-governmental organization with a charter or a mandate that comes from the UN Conventions on the Rights of the Child. And so the idea is, to show this within that context, the context of furthering children's rights and human rights in general, and giving this back to the communities that participated in it.
Eric Maddox's film is called 48 Generations. It screens tomorrow, Friday, at 3:10 at the Jean Cocteau Theater here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome Tim Blair. His film is called Local Color. It's one of the 10 documentary films. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you looked around in Santa Fe and saw these painted boxes on the sidewalk all over the place.
That's right. It was... I know it's called The City Different, and I thought, well, that's something I'd never seen in another city. And
they're utility boxes.
At each intersection has a traffic light. There's a control box that controls the timing of the light, and they're pretty ubiquitous. I'm just used to seeing them or not seeing them. They kind of blend in. After you just get used to seeing utility boxes in cities, and then here, especially if you stop at an intersection and you're looking around, and there's these art pieces there.
Yeah, some people, probably young people, have painted them.
Exactly. And so I thought, I just kind of got used to that. Okay, it's part of Santa Fe. There's mural art on the walls. There's sculptures along the streets. And now here's these painted boxes. And then after a while, I just didn't think much about them until I started, you look at them a little more, and I'd see, oh, they say something on this community youth mural program. And I think I'd heard about that elsewhere. They did some other things that I sort of heard about somewhere, and I started to get curious what was that program? And so I thought, well, let me look into that, and took the camera and started asking whoever I should ask, and one thing led to another, and there's lots of stories involved there.
And you've told some of those stories in your film.
A little bit. I found like the tip of a lot more that there could be, but so it's amazing.
So is this a short? Did you end up making a short film?
It's pretty short. It's probably like 20 minutes, and it's pretty much from my point of view. I feel like there's a lot more that could be said, so it's told from my point of view as this is something I was interested in. Here's some people I met, and so I met just a few artists, a few of the many that it could have been. I went to the Arts Commission. They have archives there, and so I was able to look up some footage of when they were being painted and the lead artist who was teaching the people. One thing that was surprising to me about those traffic boxes is that it's all done with spray paint, which I wouldn't think of to look at them. You know,
right.
They look like they're brushed on or something, but it's all done with spray paint. Sometimes it might be applied with other tools, but it all comes out of a spray paint can.
Very interesting. The film is called Local Color by Tim Blair. It screens tomorrow night, Friday, at 8:35 p.m. at the Jean Cocteau Theater. And we've just got another moment left, and we want to return to Professor Tom Horn, who's working in documentary studies at the Santa Fe Community College. Many more films. We don't have really time to talk about them more, but there's another... Another five films
that we haven't had
of the
guests
ten.
For,
we've
yeah.
talked to five mm-hmm. of the filmmakers. Incredible work that they're doing. If people want to make their own documentary film or get more involved in this, are there classes coming up in the future?
Well, what I'm looking forward to is the College of Santa Fe getting started again with their documentary studies program. They have started up again this fall, as you probably know, but there is no documentary studies right now.
Right.
And Tony O'Brien, who ran that program, did a wonderful job and worked with photography, sent students to Brazil every year, and I would love to see that get started. I'd love to get my job back there if we can do that.
Right. Yeah. And big question marks about the College of Santa Fe in the future, but meanwhile, Santa Fe Community College has a program.
It does. I'm actually not involved with it this fall because they were nice enough to bring me over for the fall, but they have for the summer, but they have a full panoply of professors already there, and wonderful courses. Yeah, absolutely, it's a wonderful program out there.
The Jean Cocteau Theater tomorrow afternoon and evening, Friday, August 28th. Runs from 3 in the afternoon until 9 at night. It's screenings of the students of the College of Santa Fe Documentary Studies Program and the Santa Fe Community College Summer Intensive. Tom Horn, one of the professors involved with this. And once again, that's a free program. Thank you all so much.
Thank you very much for having us. We really appreciate it.
We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be back in a moment with Ron Strauss. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I am delighted now to welcome Ron Strauss. He is a composer, and his new disc is titled Tangos de Santa Fe Matapolvos, and he has a new septet titled Five Pieces of the Puzzle, which Serenata of Santa Fe will premiere on their first concert of the fall season on Sunday, September 13th at 3 at the Santuario de Guadalupe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
Let's talk about the disc for a few minutes. The name of the disc is the two pieces on the disc, Tangos de Santa Fe and Matapolvos. The tangos is something that comes from quite a while back in your own musical history.
Very much so. I've actually always been interested in the different Hispanic rhythms and harmonies. And somewhere in the 70s, I got very interested in tangos and started listening to them.
And really the classics, I mean the Argentine classic tangos, Carlos Gardel and whatnot.
Absolutely, and even I started researching when it began, you know, in the way before World War I. And the style of the music has evolved a lot since then, from 1910 through what we're familiar with from the movies, Carlos Gardel, and of course Hollywood's steamy versions, and contemporary versions of the tango, Astor Piazzolla's tangos, and many others. But I've always had just an affinity for them, and my own version of them is a little slow and probably more comparable to the early tangos than the contemporary modern tangos of today.
So when you, I mean, I was, how do I say this? When I put the disc in to listen to it, I thought, okay, contemporary 20th, 21st century composer, it's going to be hard to listen to. It's completely beautiful and really classic in its harmonies and just the beauty of the way the instruments go together.
Oh, thanks. I kind of challenged myself to stay within very, very old-fashioned, simple harmonic structures. I take a little liberties with the 32-bar form, you know, stretch that here and there. But I did want to evoke that period of time, and it's kind of nostalgic, dreamy, lyrical, reminiscent of another time rather than contemporary cutting-edge tango.
We'll hear a clip in a little while, but it's a very beautiful use of flute, English horn, and guitar. And maybe this is, I mean, I'm not a musician or a professor of music by any means, but that I'd never really heard or been conscious of hearing that combination of flute and English horn. They go so beautifully together.
The English horn is, I tend to favor the lower instruments the lower sound. I played the cello when I was younger rather than the violin. And the English horn is, of course, a lower version of the oboe, and it's rarely featured as a solo instrument or as part of a group. It's always tucked away for a little vignette in the orchestra, you know, somewhere, you know, Wagner uses it, an English horn solo in one of his operas. It's very famous, but it's not usually taken as a solo instrument, and I tended to use it here because of its range and its low register, almost like a clarinet, but it has a dreamier quality than the bright soprano sound of an oboe.
And also the guitar, so you have these three instruments, and I was struck by there's a real balance of the instruments so that nobody is always foregrounded.
Right. Yeah, I like to have a dialogue or a trialogue going between all the instruments. And in almost all the music I write, since I've been writing a lot of chamber music rather than orchestral, I really like to get the quality of each individual instrument across and how it relates to the other instruments. So there are lots of sounds of duets, even in this trio. You know, sometimes it's the two winds, sometimes it's the guitar and the flute, other times, you know, the others. And
right.
Then you bring them all together.
And so the second piece, Matapolvos, first of all, let's talk about what that word means.
Matapolvos is it's a Spanish term for... I don't know what the English... It literally means a dust killer. It's a type of rain that's not enough to... barely enough to settle the dust, but it's not a real downpour.
We know those.
We certainly do here in Santa Fe. And the term came to me because I was setting poems... Actually, they're not poems. They're texts of Eduardo Galeano, Uruguayan writer, from his books on the history of Latin America, Memory of Fire. It's a trilogy. And this book moved me immensely, and I wasn't able to, you know, make a dent in some nearly 1,000 pages. So I just picked a few things, and for me it was just like I was able to sprinkle a little water on this real fire cloud of history.
Oh, how interesting.
So there's a whole lot more that, you know, if I had a lifetime to set this piece to music, I would, you know, but you've got to move on with your life.
So when you take texts and you pick them out and you set them to music, how does the content of the text affect what you write musically?
In this case, it determined very much what I wrote. I took the text, and I first read it in English. I had friends who were in South America, and they brought back a Spanish copy of it. And so then I knew the meaning of it. My Spanish is not fluent. And I just had to work with the rhythm of the words and the meaning, and from that just develop a musical style. Also trying to stay within Latino, Hispanic format, but the music of Matapolvos is not quite as simple harmonically and melodically as the tangos are.
And when you're working with voice, no matter how much balance you try to achieve among the instruments, the voice really is the front man, so to speak.
It's the focus, although I do try to weave it in one of the pieces, Alguien, someone. I just tried to make it seem like another instrument, and there's sort of an echoing thing going back and forth between the voice and the other instruments.
Now, these were recorded at the Santuario de Guadalupe?
Yes. And
nice acoustics.
Beautiful, warm, rich, moist acoustics. Yeah, a lovely place to perform in. and to record in.
So when you do a recording like that, just out of curiosity, do you find yourself doing multiple takes, or do you play it as if it were a concert, just going straight through?
We did both with this for this recording. First, I think we did just play them through, and then everybody sort of would say, what do you think of that? And, oh, well, I don't know, wasn't so great around here. Let's do that again. But the Matapolvos we really did in a few takes, and the tangos, because the acoustics in there are so different from a rehearsal room and a guitar has a lighter sound in the balance, we had to do quite a few several takes and do a lot of sort of splicing in, which was a lot more work than I thought it was going to be.
The acoustics of that space lend themselves to recording, but then in editing, do you have to in any way enhance or change the sound, or do you just really leave it?
We just took it straight as it was. David Dunn, who did the recording, had made his own microphones. He was very familiar with the space, and he also did the editing. And the editing, we pretty much left it as it was. There are no effects. No pushing up and down. So we did just try to capture the sound as it was there.
Let's talk about the septet, five pieces of the puzzle.
Okay.
What are the instruments that you have?
The instruments for that are, I have two winds, clarinet and oboe, four strings, which are a violin, viola, cello and bass.
Nice.
And a piano.
Interesting. Now, I guess as a contemporary composer, you can do anything you want. Is that a typical septet, or
Not at all. No, I always, as with the two pieces on the disc, I try to take instruments that you aren't used to hearing together, and then it's my challenge to try to work with them and get a satisfying sound out of them. So I don't know of a septet with this combination. There may be, some. But I was just interested in how to balance not even a regular string quartet, which is usually two violins, viola and cello, and I just had one violin and added the bass. And how does that balance with the piano and winds and still get a very full sound, and again, keeping it more like a dialogue between the instruments rather than a massive orchestral sound.
Now, what's the five pieces? Is it in five movements?
It's five movements and five pieces, basically. And as I was writing it, the title only came to me after I was writing it. I kind of had an idea what I wanted to write, but I didn't know how to describe it. And in each piece, there'll be sort of an echo or a reflection of another piece. And so it's a little bit like jigsaw puzzles where there's a little bit of red on this corner and it matches with a little piece of red on that corner of the next piece. So there's some elements that are shared between these pieces, but then they're still individual enough like pieces in the puzzle that don't, they fit together in one way, but they, I hope, suggest more than what they individually contain.
Ron Strauss is a composer. His new disc is titled Tangos de Santa Fe Matapolvos, and the septet is called Five Pieces of the Puzzle. It's the premiere at the first concert of the fall season of Serenata de Santa Fe, September 13th at 3 in the afternoon. That's a Sunday at the wonderful Santuario de Guadalupe. How can people get hold of your disc?
The disc is available here in Santa Fe at Collected Works Bookstore on Galisteo. It's also at Fourth World Imports on West San Francisco Street. And
which is that nice upstairs location with all the Latin American
absolutely
folk art and crafts.
A wonderful shop. Wonderful people. And if you don't get downtown there, it's also available online at cdbaby.com.
cdbaby.com. Yeah. Ron Strauss, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And we're going to go out with some music from Tangos de Santa Fe. Thank you. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can also find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz continues its series of featuring different interpretations of famous songs. Today, it's One for My Baby.